You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, do you know your life expectancy? What's the number that pops into your head? We know the average life expectancy has been going up for the most part for decades. It's already much higher probably than whenever you were born. And our next guest says thanks to cutting-edge medical and technological advances, it's likely we're all going to live a lot longer in the future. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about some of the latest research in longevity, living longer and living healthier along the way, our guest says? Is there a medical development that you look back on and say, yeah, that's helped me live a lot longer, or someone in my family? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you want to live to 150? Does that sound like a good idea? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Dr. Michael Roizen is Emeritus Chief Wellness Officer at the Cleveland Clinic and a professor at the Cleveland Clinic Lerner College of Medicine at Case Western Reserve University. His books include What to Eat When and Age Proof. He's co-author of the new book, The Great Age Reboot, Cracking the Longevity Code for a Younger Tomorrow. Dr. Roizen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, it's a privilege to join you. Thank you very much.
Before we dig into some of the specific developments, you and your co-authors are saying we're really on the verge of something big when it comes to longevity. How much could things change in the next 50 years or so?
Well, in the next 10 years, we expect that life expectancy will increase by about 30 years with an 80% probability. Let me go back a little bit. We've increased life expectancy, that is sanitation, public health, and the medical community, medical science community, has gone from about 42 or 43 in 1890 to about 78 now. And we expect with at least an 80% probability, because there are what we call 14 shots on goal, 14 hot areas of exponentially increasing research into the basic mechanism of aging that have been going on and that have transformed, each has transformed at least two animal species. We expect that a 30-year increase in life expectancy will be probable. In 1998, when Real Age came out, when we published Real Age, we said that 60 was likely to be the new 40. It has happened. We're now saying that 90 is likely to be the new 40. That is, you won't just be living longer, you'll be living younger.
One thing I want to get into at the outset here is people might hear the technologies you're talking about and think, great, I don't need to take care of myself. Medical science is going to fix whatever goes wrong with me, you know, in the next 20 or 30 years or whatever. That is exactly the opposite of what you're encouraging people to think. Could you tell us how you're hoping this influences our behavior today?
That's exactly right, because although sometime in the future, maybe by 2050, you'll go in a car wash as a 90-year-old at one end and come out a 40-year-old at the other end. But for the foreseeable future, it's organ system by organ system, which means that in order to enjoy this longevity, the changes that are happening, that we've got to keep ourselves as young as possible so that the organs don't get what you would call structural change that's irreparable before the change happens that's allowing us to reboot them to a younger organ. And so the point is we've got to do everything we can. In fact, it's kind of our responsibility to society to do everything we can as well as to ourselves to keep everything as young as possible, especially your brain and nervous system, because that's the one we expect to be the hardest to reboot.
Talking to Dr. Michael Roizen about his new book, The Great Age Reboot, Cracking the Longevity Code for a Younger Tomorrow. You can join in with your thoughts, your reactions to what you're hearing, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. All right, Dr. Roizen, let's look at what might be in the works today. Let's start off with the idea of, a 3D printer. We've seen those, but maybe 3D printers that can give us replacement organs?
Yeah, in fact, one of the joys of this, of being in the field that I'm in, that is getting to follow longevity, is they had a contest last year. It was an open contest for the last 5 years. Who would be the first to be able to print a viable, functioning in all three areas, liver? And Team Winston at Winston-Salem University, at Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, won that last year. The liver is a complex organ. It both produces proteins, it excretes compounds, including drugs. It has bile ducts as well as arteries and veins. And it's incredibly important in synthesis, in excretion, and in metabolism. And they, working with human stem cells, working with living stem cells from people's bone marrow, were able to reproduce a human liver. Now, we already know we can produce bones, we can produce jaws, we can even produce tracheas, but this was a breakthrough in producing a liver, which is it's maybe the third or fourth most complex organ in the human body.
How far are we from, that proof of concept, I guess, to, we need a transplant of a complex organ like a liver, and we don't need a donor. We can grow one, maybe using some of our own biology.
So whether we get the breakthrough in this area or in one of the others, we expect that every one of these 14 areas has done this in at least two animal species. So they've done the liver transplant in pigs and in mice. Now it is, so you're saying, how long before it's ongoing. It'll be ongoing in humans experimentally. And we expect within 10 years, each of these areas will have a breakthrough into humans, that at least one of them will succeed. So my favorite, of course, is, and my co-author Albert Ratner's favorite, is the regressing of white fat to what we call mother fat, pluripotent fat, and then its transformation into brown fat and eliminating obesity and all the diseases such as arthritis and type 2 diabetes and the other diseases that go along with it. What do we mean? So when you're young, when you're a newborn, you have brown fat. It surrounds your key organs and keeps them warm when your mom can't swaddle you or doesn't have the time to swaddle you at all times to keep you warm. But it comes from what we call mother fat or pluripotent fat. In three species, and I'll tell you the largest one was sheep, and we'll tell you why in a second, they regressed the white fat that we have around our intestines and that hangs off our belly and that causes inflammation in us to mother fat, and then turned it into brown fat and eliminated obesity. The largest animal was sheep. Why did they do it in sheep at Clemson? Well, they did it there because it turns out sheep can't stop eating either, and they develop non-alcoholic fatty liver disease just like humans, and die and stop being able to produce wool, so that the sheep farmers wanted that to see if they could do that. And so that's been done in at least sheep experimentally. So these are some of the changes. Now you'd say, are there inexpensive ones? And yes, as well as some of those that are more designed, such as gene therapy, and more specific and expensive. We just had an approval of gene therapy for beta thalassemia and sickle cell disease in the United States. A expensive therapy, it uses relatively inexpensive parts, if you will, drugs, but the drug company charges a lot because of the regulatory approval process and because of their profit motive. But in fact, some of these are already approved drugs that are very inexpensive.
Bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Elizabeth is with us in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm all for having people be healthy, but I really don't understand the increased longevity piece, because we already have a lack of medical health workers. lack of CNAs and other people in nursing homes and in the medical field. We have older people who are lonely, and I'm just not understanding increasing, you know, till age 90 or beyond when there's already not enough help for people.
Elizabeth, thanks for the call. Great questions. And Dr. Roizen, you and your co-authors talk about some of the social and economic adaptations this increase in longevity would require.
Right. I think her name was Elizabeth, the caller, and I apologize
Elizabeth,
if I missed
the
name. But Elizabeth, so take a 90-year-old of now isn't going to be the 90-year-old of 10 years from now. That's why longevity will be a huge disruptor. And that's really why we wrote the book, so that people can plan for it. Because a 90-year-old will function like the 40-year-old of today. That's with at least an 80% probability. And what do we mean by that? Well, instead of work life being from 20 or 25 to 65, if you retire at 65 and live to 115, you're not going to want to do that because you're going to do nothing for 50 years. So you're going to expand work life from 25 to 65 to from 25 to maybe 90 or 95. And that's going to be productive work life. Think of the 95-year-old as a 55-year-old or a 60-year-old today. That's what it's going to be like. And yes, you're absolutely right. We don't have enough healthcare workers and care accessibility for the elderly now. But this change, just like we've jumped over, I mean, the chip was the last disruptor about 60 years ago. And it's improved our lives in substantial ways. We now have more power in our phones than we did for all of IBM 360 computers that took rooms of chips, if you will, in the past. Well, that same power is going to occur in medicine, we believe, and longevity will be the next disruptor, and it will make, if we plan for it right, and I can tell you already, Australia, Singapore, and Denmark are planning for it fiscally correctly. If we do that as well as they do it, and that's really why we wrote the book, to get that discussion going. If we plan for it as well as they did it, it will cause an enormous thriving in, if you will, Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, because we'll be able to have much better access, because we won't be dealing with many of the chronic diseases at any place near as early as we have to deal with them now. Just imagine eliminating obesity and the consequences. Most arthritis is due to obesity and it's in and the inflammation causes. Most type 2 diabetes is due to that. A lot of cardiovascular disease and cancer and dementia are due to that. Well, imagine eliminating that, Elizabeth, and that's what you've got, and that's why it really does take a mind shift and an emotional change to understand how big this disruptor is likely to be.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Dr. Michael Roizen, Emeritus Chief Wellness Officer at the Cleveland Clinic. His new book is The Great Age Reboot, Cracking the Longevity Code for a Younger Tomorrow. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts, your reactions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Dr. Michael Roizen, Emeritus Chief Wellness Officer at the Cleveland Clinic, looking at his new book, The Great Age Reboot, Cracking the Longevity Code for a Younger Tomorrow. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to our callers. Jeanette is with us in Sparta. Jeanette, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I was just listening to it and kind of thinking about kind of how our country operates in terms of, you know, public institutions like universities coming up with these really great technologies. And then once they get passed off to the pharmaceutical industry and the medical industry, they end up, you know, prices skyrocket and the average person can't afford them. So I'm wondering what your guest
interesting
feels about that.
Jeanette, thanks for the call. Dr. Roizen, today's economic disparities when it comes to health, will they just be replicated with these new longevity technologies?
You know, the hope is not, but the fear is yes. And that's why, again, why we wrote the book, to talk about the policies. And so the first third of the book is on these 14 areas of research. The next third is on the policies and economics of it. And the last third is what you can do to prepare for it, both financially and physically, that is, in your medical care. But some of these are very cheap. Let me give you two examples. At the Gladstone, I'll give you three examples because I can't resist. At the Gladstone in San Francisco, they looked at every drug already approved by the FDA and looked at their ability to block the functioning of the APOE4 gene, which is known to increase dementia by about threefold. They found that Bumetamide, which is a $4 a month water pill, already approved now, $4 a month, it's generic, won't go back, it won't become non-generic. So $4 a month, and it reversed 70% of the functioning of that gene, so that in fact, when they looked at people taking that water pill in a 12 million person database compared to people taking other water pills, Bumex, decreased the incidence of dementia 70%. That now is undergoing, under NIH's auspices, a very, if you will, not a private drug company, a randomized controlled trial to look, does it do it in a prospective group? At the Cleveland Clinic, they did the same, but looked at the difference in protein attachment of tau and amyloid with every approved drug. Again, they looked at 1,563 drugs and found that Viagra, women use Viagra for pulmonary hypertension, men for erectile dysfunction. They found that Viagra decreased the attachment and decreased in a 15 million person database. 69% it decreased dementia rates. That's now undergoing, again, a randomized controlled trial under NIH auspices. And the two together, bumetamide and Viagra, are undergoing it together. Those are both generic drugs, so they should be very inexpensive in the future. Now, let me give you one more. My favorite example of all, I told you, my co-author, Mr. Ratner, Albert Ratner's favorite, which was, of course, the transformation of white fat to brown fat. But my favorite is actually in the AMBAR studies, AMBAR, which was a plasma exchange. Now, we do plasma exchange, donation of plasma, and we pay college students and graduate students, et cetera, to do it. So it's not very expensive. You take away the plasma, you wash the red cells, give those back, and you replace the plasma with salt water, saline. Doing that in patients with early Alzheimer's disease reversed this in a randomized controlled trial of around 300 people, what we call phase 2B, 3A study, sponsored by a foundation. Now, the technology to do this is not solely owned by any one company, and they're now, but that foundation is now sponsoring a 3,000, and by the way, it was done at six places worldwide, two in Spain, two in Chile, and the University of Pittsburgh and Cleveland Clinic in the United States. It's now being done in 100 different sites for 3,000 patients, and within 2 or 3 years, we'll know if this is a viable technique for preventing dementia. And by the way, when it was used in animal models, it also prevented skin aging. It reversed the aging of muscle and pancreas, and even, if you will, other cardiovascular system organs. And this stemmed from the young blood to old animals made the old animal young. Well, it wasn't that it was the young blood to the old animal. It was the old animal getting rid of its old proteins. And this is thought that it relates to protein misformation or malformation in that is still lingering in plasma And us not having young proteins or normal signaling proteins in our blood. So we'll know within 3 years whether that, and that's really cheap. And the good news is they're competitors in the field. And so it shouldn't be very expensive at all for those. And there, if you look at the 14 areas, at least 7 of them are very inexpensive and should be able to be have competitors enough that they will be and stay inexpensive.
And Dr. Roizen, just in our last half a minute or so, leave us with one piece of health advice to protect ourselves until these things come online.
You're a genetic engineer. So when you exercise and stress a muscle, it turns on a gene that produces a risin that goes to the blood-brain barrier and increases the size of your hippocampus, your memory center in your brain. So by you speed of processing games, are the one game, crossword puzzles a little bit, executive a little bit, but speed of processing games and speed of exercise, stressing muscles, are two very important things for your brain.
Dr. Roizen, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Rob. The questionnaires.
That's Dr. Michael Roizen, Emeritus Chief Wellness Officer at the Cleveland Clinic, Professor at the Cleveland Clinic Lerner College of Medicine at Case Western Reserve University. We've been talking about his new book, The Great Age Reboot, Cracking the Longevity Code for a Younger Tomorrow. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, people are sharing their stories of living with disabilities in a new online series at the New York Times. We'll find out lessons learned from the Adaptability Project. And Jonathan Van Ness from the series Queer Eye is coming to Wisconsin for a series of shows. We'll get a preview, some lessons on coping with tough times and finding and sharing joy, plus pumpkins. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, the lead up to Wisconsin's midterm elections next month has seen a lot of discussion about crime and public safety. We'll talk to a media ethics expert about the role fear and race play in campaign rhetoric around those topics. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, OPEC cut oil shipments by up to 2 million barrels a day. We'll find out what that means for gas prices and possible responses from President Biden and Congress. First, crime and public safety have been major talking points in Wisconsin's upcoming midterm elections. Republicans are attacking Democrats with ads about crime rates and police funding, while Democrats have pushed back, in some cases pointing toward gun control and bail reform. If you've watched anything that includes commercials lately, you've probably seen many examples of these campaign ads. Election rhetoric about crime can often tap into feelings of fear and spread into wider societal issues involving race and justice. And our next guest says that can make it even more important to be mindful of how the media covers these topics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How important of an issue is crime and public safety in the upcoming election? If it's important to you, tell us why. Or if not, why not? And what do you think of the campaign ads you've seen on this issue? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Kathleen Bartson-Culver is the James E. Burgess Chair in Journalism Ethics, Associate Professor in the UW-Madison School of Journalism, and Director of the Center for Journalism Ethics. Katie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much, Rob. Great to be here.
This isn't the first election cycle where crime-related messaging has been front and center. Why do you think it's been so prominent here in 2022?
Well, I think it's generally prominent because fear often works. And I think this year we may be more fearful than we've ever been. And I think that's why we're seeing more of it.
More fearful than we've ever been. How so?
We're coming out of a pandemic that I think I can speak for almost everybody scared us and scared us deeply. So fear is a running undercurrent. We're also facing a lot of divisions. And when we are divided, we tend to fear others. It's a real problem for us right now.
Now, there's a little bit of chicken or egg here. Republicans are mostly running these ads related to crime to attack Democratic opponents. Are they responding, do you think, to real concerns about crime in the public, or are they inflaming them on this issue in a way that Republicans would see as more advantageous to them? I'm guessing it's a little of both. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, part of what makes the chicken and egg issue unsolvable is that the answer is usually both. So we are seeing this as, clearly something that is being pushed by Republican candidates nationally, but right here at home in Wisconsin. But I think they're not responding to nothing. They are responding to folks' concerns about crime. We do have in Wisconsin, coming out of the pandemic, property crimes, things like theft and burglary, those are actually down, but violent crime is up. Wisconsin still enjoys a lower rate of violent crime than we see nationally, which I think is, yet another reason this is a great state to live in. But it's something that people are aware of and concerned about. I also would say, sensational crimes like the horror of the Waukesha Christmas parade do tend to focus people's attention as well.
Big issues related to bail reform came out big time after the murder of George Floyd a couple years ago. We had for a while there, Koch brothers founded conservative groups working with liberal groups on releasing people from prison, on bail reform and things like that. Did you think we might see some convergence, some bipartisan work on these issues?
I sure did, because there is a place at which prison reform and bail reform actually is a meeting of the minds between liberals and conservatives. Conservatives very concerned about the cost of mass incarceration, and liberals concerned about civil rights issues, racial disparities, and those sorts of things. I have to be honest, sometimes I sit and watch TV at night and I watch these political commercials, and I can scarcely believe that 34 years after the infamous Willie Horton ad in 1988, we're getting much of the same content and in some cases worse.
Talking to Kathleen Culver from UW-Madison School of Journalism, looking at crime as a campaign issue, the ads related to crime and public safety. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What are you seeing when you see campaign ads? Do you just mute them and move on? Are you worried about the imaging? Are you voting based in part on your concerns about crime and public safety? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Katie, I know we don't necessarily look to political advertising as, a source of the truth necessarily, but where do you see ads really straying too far from the truth, do you think, misrepresenting what's actually going on in the United States?
Rob, I think that's just such an unfortunate statement. I don't think it's an untrue statement that you're making there. But, it's not just, yes, I run the Center for Journalism Ethics, but it's not just journalists who should be having ethical foundations in their work. All public communicators have obligations to the truth. They have obligations to minimize harm. Their obligation is not to do anything at all costs to win. I think it's we as citizens are right to question these kinds of ads and ask, what is it that someone is trying to stoke in me? What does it mean that someone is playing to my fears, and how might that affect my vote? Sadly, we know from research, one of the principal effects of this kind of fear-based advertising is that it drives voter turnout down. It's less about getting an individual voter to select one candidate over another, but instead they respond to the fear saying, I'm out. I'm backing out completely from this entire thing.
Issues of race come up when we talk about crime and punishment in the United States. How do these campaign ads affect our conversations about race?
Well, I hope that they affect them in a way that we can be open and honest and talk about how much race is featured in these ads, and how little that we have not come far at all since Willie Horton in 1988. This is a time where, coming off of the protests in 2020, the murder of George Floyd, we have an obligation to discuss this, to think about this. What does it mean? Do I fear other people because they are portrayed as, people of another race are portrayed as the criminal element in my state, when that's not really the case?
What do you hope to see from the news media when it comes to coverage of crime in the campaign?
Well, I hope that news media will be there to help supply people with verified information about what crime rates do look like, what the actual cost of enforcement is, things like mass incarceration. And I hope that they'll actually cover what it means to think about these fear-based appeals. You know, I often tell people, whenever you encounter content on social media or political ad or a news story, if it triggers an emotion in you, like fear or a sense of threat, that's when you need to stop and think the most carefully. You know, check that emotion, seek out reliable facts. News media should be part of that. But at a time when local news media are disappearing at an unprecedented rate, and people may live in news deserts, that just gives the fear-based appeals all the more oxygen.
One thing that's fairly new when it comes to political campaigns is you mentioned social media and things like YouTube advertising. Do you see things working differently there as opposed to, say, you see the ad during the news or the Packers game?
Yeah, it's incredibly more targeted, Rob. So those, you know, algorithms are driving a lot of the content that you encounter on social media in a way they're not driving content that you encounter on your local television station. And I guarantee over the next few days, because I was doing some background research today to prepare for this interview, and I was looking at crime rates in Wisconsin and that sort of thing, I guarantee that my YouTube pre-roll advertising as I watch things over the coming weeks will include more of these crime-laden, fear-based appeals because the algorithm thinks that that's what I'm looking for.
We're talking about the politics of crime and public safety and fear in the upcoming midterm elections. UW-Madison Journalism Ethics Professor Katie Culver stays with us, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. You can give us a field report if you watch broadcast TV or streaming TV or YouTube videos. Are you seeing a lot of ads related to crime and safety on whatever you're watching? Do you feel like they are, in fact, targeting you? What do you think of those ads? And do you have thoughts on crime as an issue in this race? Is it going to motivate your vote? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Katie Culver, journalism professor, director of the Center for Journalism Ethics at UW-Madison. She's with us today looking at crime as an election issue in the midterms this year, the role that race and fear can play in ads and media coverage, and what media coverage could look like. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and what you're seeing in whatever you're watching. Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Art is with us in Milwaukee. Art, hi.
Hi. So I'm a semi-retired lawyer. I did actually write a little piece on the whole cash bail thing. So what Mandela is being charged with is supporting a bill shortly after Chris Christie in New Jersey signed the same thing to repeal cash bail and follow the federal system, which Ronald Reagan signed into law. But they put it on TV and pretend as though the repealing cash bail would mean everybody gets out of jail free regardless of danger, which is what the federal system looks at, whether you're a danger to society rather than how much money you've got. So, I've written to the media and said, I think you should cover this story and give it some depth with a little bit of response, but not much.
All right. Thanks for that call. Katie, I've talked to experts on the cash bail system here. And yeah, the point of cash bail was to make sure people show up for their court appointments. It sort of morphed into a public safety measure. It's a complicated issue that gets maybe heavily simplified when you're writing a campaign ad.
I think Art is spot on that this is one of those things where we have had some bipartisan progress on this issue, but is being reduced to something that's just not an accurate perception or not an accurate assessment of the situation. And I'm really delighted to hear that Art participates and contacts news media and says this is worth covering and here are some things that you ought to know about it. You know, we as citizens should be participating in what the news environment looks like and what the information around us is informing us. And I think you know, it's hard for news media because, you know, the average television news reporter, for instance, might cover, you know, a criminal hearing, a legislative bill, an education proposal, all in the same day. And they can't have expertise on all of that. So when a person like Art has expertise, I do encourage you to contact news media and provide that and suggest story ideas worth covering.
Thanks for the call, Art. Martha joins us now in Wisconsin. Martha, hi.
Hi. I just want to say that I'm very discouraged and I'm angry. I'm not fearful. I'm angry more than anything else about the ads. And what it does is I can't believe anything that politicians say. My family and my friends are so discouraged with the political system and with and honestly, with the news media, too, because nowadays you can't tell what's true and what isn't unless you've witnessed it yourself. And even then it gets twisted one way or the other, and it's just very frustrating. So what it does is it makes me not want to vote, but I am going to vote, but I end up voting along party lines, and that's not the person I want to be. But I can't help it because I can't tell what's true and what isn't.
Martha, thanks for that call. And Katie, I think a lot of people share some version of Martha's experience feeling discouraged, disillusioned, and distrustful based on what they see in these ads and maybe in the media in general, it sounds like.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking to hear, Martha. But I, you know, the word discouraged came out multiple times, but I do applaud you that you are going to go and try to vote. One of the things that I encourage people when they are feeling that sense that, you know, their political efficacy is sapped, they don't know who to believe, I encourage them to do a couple of things. So one is I say, go see for yourself. So I think there is value. You know, tomorrow, our U.S. Senate candidate debate is tomorrow at 6:30, or excuse me, 6 o'clock. So Thursday at 6, watch that. See for yourself. You know, read the news stories that cover it, but see for yourself. The other thing is, I would look at candidates, and I often encourage people to ask the question: is there any other way to look at this? So when I think about these ads that are pumping crime and bringing in not even just racial undertones, but racial overtones, I say, think about what is affecting you where you are in Wisconsin. So when I talk to people, I hear a lot of concerns about opioids and fentanyl. And those are things that, you know, are criminalized, but we've come a long way in talking about the need to look at them differently. And so instead of, you know, instead of thinking about them through a law enforcement lens, we think about them through a treatment lens. So ask, you know, go to a candidate website, see what they have to say. You know, this is definitely a scourge in Wisconsin. Does anybody have a plan or a thought that would influence your vote in that regard? But please, I know you're angry, Martha, and other people are fearful, but stay engaged, because that's the only way we're going to have power to fix anything, is if we stay engaged and we vote.
Thanks for calling in, Martha, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Katie Culver from the UW-Madison Journalism School, looking at crime as a political campaign issue. Back to your calls. Mary is with us in Wauwatosa. Mary, hi.
Hi. I am also discouraged, but the reason I'm calling now is my 6-year-old grandson rarely watches television, but he does watch sports, the Packers and the Brewers, et cetera. And these ads are on all of those sports shows. So he comes into the kitchen and starts asking his mom about the murders and the murderers. And it's just so sad and so really inappropriate to have these ads on shows that kids are watching. And that's my comment.
Mary, thanks a lot for that call. My kids are a little older now, Katie. I hadn't really thought about that angle.
I am so with Mary on this, that, you know, we tend to think about the effects of, you know, violent video games or violent movies or television shows on children. But what is the effect of advertising is also an important question to ask. And I wish I had a solution for you, Mary. But I would say, you know, again, ethics isn't just for journalists anymore. So people who are creating and paying to run these ads have public responsibility too, and we should do our best to try to hold them accountable. Someone who is trying to play to my fears is not going to get my vote.
Mary, thanks for that call. Jeff joins us now in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, I remember a few minutes ago you asked about social media platforms, and I deactivated my Twitter account because it's not so innocent. Not only are there fake accounts, but some of the stuff they are saying is simply not true. So I don't even go to Twitter anymore. I deleted my account. But I do go to Instagram, and I do go on YouTube videos. And what I found that helps me is I go to certain influencers, and if I trust them, then over the long term, I get a feel for their values and ethics. And sometimes, you know, if they make an endorsement or a comment, I might agree with them. But then I'm actually walking with somebody instead of just blindly going through a forest wondering what's going on.
Jeff, thanks a lot. Katie, that's interesting. Jeff's working to curate the news and information he's getting online.
That's fantastic, Jeff. I mean, congratulations on media literacy. You know, as long as you're being careful about the influencers you follow, you know, you're not just picking out a Kardashian or a Jenner and following them. I think that's a really good way to go about it. I would say stay alert, stay mindful to the algorithms and what gets delivered to you. YouTube has gotten a lot more intentional about trying to scrub mis and disinformation and untrue things from its platform, but it's still loaded with it. And algorithms can deliver to you things that subvert your own attempts to be literate in this information environment.
Jeff, thanks a lot for calling in. Katie, with the social media feeds we get, I talked to someone about YouTube a while back. These algorithms are pretty opaque, and we might start off with something in our comfort zone, and it might steer us down the proverbial rabbit hole. How can we protect ourselves from kind of walking into more and more weird and fringe stuff?
One positive step is to go only through the searches that you choose and stay away from the suggestions. So on that right rail, it's okay, try to watch this next. That's where some really noxious stuff can come up. I remember one time before the 2016 election, I was looking for something covering a candidate debate for the Republican primary. And I got fed a video that Michelle Obama was born a man. And I was astonished, and I reported it to YouTube. But you find that a lot of the problematic content comes not from your own searching, but from the algorithm recommending content to you.
Can you leave us with some media literacy advice that you might share with your own students, say, as we approach Election Day?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, I am a big fan of see for yourself and ask the question, is there any other way to look at this? I would also say, just be aware of what fear does to us. So, you know, when as humans, fear is actually a good thing. It can protect us from, you know, getting eaten by a lion. But we tend, when information ignites that fear, we tend to prioritize that information. We notice it first. We can remember it longer. And it can be more influential in our decision making. So I guess what I would say is acknowledge the fear, or, you know, in the case of Martha, acknowledge the anger, and then recognize what it, the potential that it has, the power it may have over you, and work to counteract that. Take steps to get information to base your vote on intentionally rather than reacting to that fear. And then finally, if people are trying to stoke that fear in you, hold them accountable.
Katie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Kathleen Barton-Culver is the James E. Burgess Chair in Journalism Ethics, Associate Professor in the UW-Madison School of Journalism, and Director of the Center for Journalism Ethics, with us today to talk about crime as a midterm election issue and the roles that fear and race play in the conversations about crime and politics. By the way, in addition to that Senate debate on Thursday, we've got a debate for governor. I believe this is the only one coming up on Friday evening. Coming up after the news, OPEC cut oil shipments, causing concern about the cost of gasoline. We'll find out what it all means for gas prices and more. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.